Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. On this Tuesday morning, evacuation orders are in place for some residents of Butte County due to the Potter's Fire burning there. It was started by lightning, and the last update by Cal Fire has it at 1,000 acres with 0% containment. Record-breaking heat is adding to the firefighting complexity around the state. Temperatures of 100 degrees or above are expected to continue for the next full week in the Sacramento region. The state's power grid has been pushed to the limit and in some cases surpassed supply, resulting in rolling blackouts for the first time in nearly 20 years. Governor Gavin Newsom addressed the heat wave and power outages yesterday afternoon.
I've maintained that, you know, golden oldie, you can't control the weather, but you can prepare for the weather events. And let me just make this crystal clear. We failed to predict and plan these shortages, and that's simply unacceptable. I am the governor. I am ultimately accountable and will ultimately take responsibility, have taken, I assure you, responsibility to immediately address this issue and move forward to make sure this simply never happens again here in the state of California.
Yet yesterday we did hit the emergency stage. However, I don't believe any rolling blackouts actually took place. Joining us now to talk about the mix of emergencies facing the state is Brian May. He's the Public Information Officer for the California Office of Emergency Services, or Cal OES. Brian, great to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I guess we need to start with the temperatures. Today could be the hottest day of this heat wave with 112 degrees in the forecast for Sacramento. This, of course, will have all of those air conditioners humming. What is the state doing to make sure there are no rolling blackouts today?
Well, I mean, we work hand in hand with the independent system operator, CAISO, making sure that we know exactly where they stand with the grid. They're the ones that manage the energy, and we're the ones that kind of manage the response as to what happens if we do happen to lose enough power, if we do have to start seeing some blackouts or shutoffs across the state. So we need to make sure that we've got emergency operations ready to go. We think about the impact it has on us as individual families, but if you consider emergency response and if we lose power, we got to make sure that the fire departments can get their bay doors open to get vehicles out. We've got to make sure that communication stays intact. We've got to make sure that people can still get emergency alerts. That the sad reality is these heat temperatures are coinciding, obviously, with really bad fire conditions. And we want to make sure that we can get alerts to people and get people out of areas if we need to in a very quickly time manner.
And we do have an evacuation underway right now. So I assume it's Cal Fire's job to battle the fires. When does OES step in the case of evacuations? Does it start at the county level and then move up?
Yeah, the evacuations are normally given from the county sheriff, and we just coordinate with them and make sure that if they need any assistance at that point in time, that we're going to step in and help them.
Brian, if there were to be a mass rolling blackout, if our energy grid were to fail on a pretty large level, how would OES step in to mitigate any problems from that?
You know, the good news is we have a lot of we train for a lot of disasters in California. The bad news is we have a lot of disasters in California. And so we're always training and preparing and building redundancies and building backup plans so that if something like you just described major were to happen, and the clip you played from the governor right before this, you said we have to always have a plan. And that truly is the case here. I think most people think about emergencies and disasters maybe 1% of the day. And for us, it's 24 hours, 7 days, 365. I mean, it's the world that we live in. And so there are plans, there are contingencies to know that, again, we've got to communicate with people. We've got to get people out in a safe manner, and we've got to have places for people to go once that happens. And that's plans, especially in this COVID environment that we've had to relook at, put a new playbook together and make sure that we're ready to go.
Yeah, I want to get to the pandemic in just a moment, but I'm wondering, for a lot of us, you know, we check our phones in the morning. We look to see what emails may have come in. I would imagine at OES, that's a whole different world with the different number of things that could possibly come in overnight. What does the start of your day look like there?
Well, it's a perfect time for you to ask that question, because about 12:30 this morning, past midnight, we had what we issued or approved what's called a fire management assistant grant. In the emergency world, we call them FMAGs, and that just frees up funding to pay for the response to these fires. If you think about the impact on a local fire department, we've got fires that we're fighting right now, that the state's fighting in Nevada County and Napa County. To pay for the fights can really tax the locals. And so we free up what's called a fire management assistance grant. And that happened, two of those happened past midnight last night. So the phone calls begin whenever they need to and end whenever they need to in that case.
So as you mentioned, you have to look at all of these things, I don't know the right word for it, that OES needs to do to tackle these emergencies, but you need to now do it in the middle of a pandemic. So how does that complicate the actions of OES?
You know, in what we call blue sky conditions, pre-pandemic, we were able to have large scale evacuation centers in high school gymnasiums. We were able to have the Red Cross set up major food distribution areas in a parking lot where they could just do buffet style food. We were able to put firefighters who were responding to these fires in camps. We used oftentimes, and still do, the county fairgrounds, and all the firefighters would be together in one fire camp. We have to change all that now. We can't have large evacuation centers in a high school gymnasium, or if we do, there's got to be social distancing. There's got to be protection there. We can't put all the firefighters in one small camp and have them all, you know, eat, sleep, and work together. We've got to make sure that we've got distancing. So it's required us, in some cases, and in a lot of areas, we're looking at hotel rooms to put people in, because that's safe distancing. The same for the firefighters, if they're available. It's just requiring us to go back and look at all of our protocols and make sure that we try and do this as safe as possible.
Yeah. Brian May with Cal OES, the Governor's Office of Emergency Services. Thank you so much for the update this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Good luck with everything.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
There's a lot going on. The Democratic National Convention is also now underway, and for the first time ever, it's being presented virtually without a main stage for the string of speakers and a big hall for the party faithful. Day two falls today on the 100th anniversary of women getting the right to vote in the U.S. Tomorrow, California Senator Kamala Harris is expected to accept her nomination as former Vice President Joe Biden's running mate. So our big conversation for today is women in politics and the centennial of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. Joining us now to talk about what we can expect out of the convention is Washington Post political reporter and author of The 5-Minute Fix. It's Amber Phillips. Welcome to Insight.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I want to start with somebody we heard from last night. It's former Republican Ohio Governor John Kasich. Here's a clip of what he had to say.
I'm a lifelong Republican, but that attachment holds second place to my responsibility to my country. That's why I've chosen to appear at this convention.
So do you believe, Amber, that we'll hear several Republican voices throughout this convention to highlight the fact that President Donald Trump is not popular within his own party?
Democrats would like that to be the case, but there haven't been a ton of Republicans like John Kasich to come out and be willing to do this.
At that level.
At that level, exactly. Privately, they're more than happy to tell you they're frustrated with Trump. And, you know, I would note that John Kasich is a former elected official, former governor. There was a former member of Congress, Susan Molinari from New York as well, a Republican who spoke last night. But beyond that, there just aren't a ton of Republicans that they can line up for the rest of the week who are willing to do this.
Mm-hmm. So the Democratic Party certainly has its factions, which were on full display last night with a Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders taking the virtual podium, you might say. Here's his clip.
This is not normal. And we must never treat it like it is. Under this administration, authoritarianism has taken root in our country.
So it was really important for expected nominee Joe Biden to get Bernie Sanders' support so that we didn't see what happened 4 years ago when there was somewhat of a split with these factions, right?
Exactly. 4 years ago, this time at the Democrats convention, there wasn't just a split. There were protests by Bernie Sanders folks inside and outside the convention, aggravated by a leak of emails that eventually we learned came from Russian hackers. This time around, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders saw in the spring that Joe Biden was going to get the nomination. And Biden made a huge effort to reach out to Sanders to make this moment, or last night's moment, happen. You know, he also folded Elizabeth Warren in to advise him on policy. And I don't think the factions in the Democratic Party are going away. But that being said, Bernie Sanders was willing to say what he had to say last night, which is, if you like me, if you voted for me, you got to vote for Joe Biden in November.
Mm-hmm. Former First Lady Michelle Obama is what I'm seeing a lot in my Twitter feeds and on Facebook. Clips from, or excerpts from her clip last night. She was pretty clear in her stance. Here's some of what she had to say.
Donald Trump is the wrong president for our country. He has had more than enough time to prove that he can do the job, but he is clearly in over his head. He cannot meet this moment.
So technically, Michelle Obama is not a politician. So what does she mean to the Democratic Party, Amber?
Well, she's one of the more popular figures in the Democratic Party, her and her husband. And so, yeah, I think her job last night was two things. One, sprinkle Obama dust on Joe Biden and say, you know, we understand voters that you might not be super excited about Biden. We're seeing that in the polls, but I need you to go out and vote for him. And then I think her second point, what was entirely her own that came through in her speech, which was to talk about and directly to Black voters in America who didn't show up in 2016 in high enough numbers to outweigh the white voters who came out for Trump. And she was saying last night, listen, I'm a Black woman. I know my voice is limited by this, but everybody, we need to go out and vote because, you know, she used really nihilistic terms about the state of the nation right now. If we don't, and this is a direct quote, how are we going to look our children in the eyes, is how she ended her speech. So she really leaned into talking to Black voters from the perspective of a popular Black politician about November.
Have you seen much of the president's reactions to her speech?
Yeah, I saw a couple of tweets. He was clearly watching Tuesday night because it's up late in Washington time here. And so he was clearly watching. And the president, you know, seemed to say that he was able to ride a wave of anti-Barack Obama sentiment to get into office. Maybe that's true. But it certainly doesn't, like, it doesn't take away from the fact that the Obamas are super popular in the Democratic Party and that Democrats are really motivated to go out and vote against Trump. And that's what Michelle Obama played into last night.
Amber, California, simply based on its size, is always a big player at the convention. But now with a Californian on the ticket as well, how do you see the state guiding Democratic Party politics moving forward?
Yeah, well, California obviously is always pushing the party to be more progressive, more liberal. Kamala Harris is a little bit slippery in trying to pin down her ideology, right? Like sometimes she supports Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All. She backed off that with her own plan when she was running for president. But I think that energy from California is going to remain in the Democratic Party, which is let's be as liberal as we possibly can be and still beat President Trump. And we heard Joe Biden say this essentially a couple weeks ago. He said, listen, if I'm elected, I'd be one of the most progressive presidents in U.S. history. He ticked off his support for major gun control measures and promoting same-sex equality in America and fighting racial injustice in America. And I think Kamala Harris will play a role in that.
Amber, if just based on the opening night, if you were able to rate it, what do you think of this virtual convention? You know, might we see elements of this moving forward even post-pandemic?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wrote a piece kind of thinking about that. I thought it was boring and awkward. That's my personal opinion. There wasn't the energy of the crowd or other people on stage to kind of move things forward or push past awkward moments. That being said, this plays right into the YouTube clip moments, right? That the younger generation especially loves that's how they love to consume media. Yeah. And so it forces politicians to keep their speeches shorter. and more clippable. I don't know if we will, if that continues after the pandemic, if we'll see like a 2004 Barack Obama speech, though, that launched his career.
Right. But we are seeing, like I mentioned earlier, Michelle Obama's clips, you know, over and over again in the Twitter and Facebook feed. So, you know, maybe that's part of it there. Amber Phillips, she is with The Washington Post and also the author of The 5-Minute Fix. Thank you for the convention update.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you with us this morning. Up next, we get a look at Kamala Harris's political career, as well as have a walk through the events that led up to the ratification of the 19th Amendment. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and our focus today is women in politics on this, the 100th anniversary of women getting the right to vote in the United States. History is being made this week as the first woman of color becomes a part of the Democratic ticket alongside Joe Biden. We're talking, of course, about California Senator Kamala Harris. She's the first Black woman and first person of Indian descent to be nominated for national office by a major political party in the United States. Cap Radio's PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols covered Harris during her presidential run last year, and he's doing the same now. So, Chris, good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Randall.
So being selected as Joe Biden's running mate isn't the only thing that's historic about Harris. What other historical firsts has she achieved?
That's right. You know, Harris has already made a lot of history. When you look at her career, you can see she was also the first Black woman from California and the first Indian American woman from anywhere in the country elected to the U.S. Senate. And she's only the second Black woman in the nation's history to achieve that position. Carol Moseley Braun of Illinois was the first back in 1992.
So Harris has reflected on her own 2016 U.S. Senate election and the groundbreaking nature of it. What has she said?
She has. In her recent book called The Truths We Hold, she wrote about that moment and she said, quote, "I had been elected to represent more than 39 million people, roughly one out of every eight Americans from all backgrounds and walks of life." And she continued and said, "It was and is a humbling and extraordinary honor." And just to add one more historical note, Harris was also the first African American and the first woman to serve as California's attorney general. So she really has made a career of breaking new ground.
Chris, you took a closer look at a label that Harris picked up during her time as attorney general. What was it and what did you learn about it?
Well, during this time, the label that really stuck with Harris was cautious, even cautious to a fault. And that's really different from her reputation now as a senator, who takes bold stands on a lot of issues, as we've talked about. But that's how many news articles and some state lawmakers described her at the time. So I decided to dig into that a bit more and see if it was an accurate label and to find out why she received it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned last week on Insight that Harris declined to take public positions on some, you know, high profile ballot measures. Is that part of why she received this marker as cautious and careful?
I think it is. I think it's central to why she got that label. She declined to take a position on voter initiatives to legalize marijuana, to reduce criminal sentences. She also stayed silent on a bill that would have required her office to investigate police shootings. And as a senator, she now supports many of these positions. But to learn about this, I spoke with McGeorge Law School Associate Dean Mary Beth Moylan. And she says the overly cautious label is not entirely fair. And that's largely because as Attorney General, Harris had some legal and some ethical considerations to make before she spoke out on topics, ones that she does not have now as senator.
I think those are very different roles. And so to me, a number of the positions that I think that she's been able to take as U.S. Senator were ones that I don't think she could have or should have taken as Attorney General.
Now, she Moylan also notes that Harris, in her role as Attorney General, was simply not in charge of setting California's priorities. That was the job of then Governor Jerry Brown.
There's also a clear distinction in the California Constitution that the governor sets the state policy. So the Attorney General needs to be subordinate in terms of making policy statements to the governor.
And Chris, we should note that other legal experts say Harris did have the power to make more change as Attorney General, especially on criminal justice reform issues, but chose not to.
That's right. And she's taken a lot of criticism on that or her lack of action there. UC Davis law professor Irene Joe says that Harris, for example, could have refused to defend the state's death penalty law when she was Attorney General. That's a topic where Harris says she's personally opposed to the death penalty.
I mean, as the Attorney General, as a prosecutor in any way, you are permitted to take whatever steps. We rely on their discretion. So she certainly could have taken a step to not support that.
Yeah, and she took some heat for that position when she first got elected as DA in San Francisco. Then our still Senator Dianne Feinstein came out against Harris's position right out of the gate, right after she was elected.
That's right.
So, Chris, there is a lot of misinformation spreading online about Harris's background. Where can people find fact checks on that?
Now, these claims are really spreading on social media, especially over the past week since she was named as Joe Biden's running mate. Our partner, PolitiFact National, has fact-checked quite a few of those, and they are also on our website, politifact.com/California.
Finally, Chris, while we have you on the line, you fact-checked a claim by President Trump and Housing Secretary Ben Carson about California. What can you tell us about that one?
Well, Trump and Carson wrote an op-ed in Sunday's Wall Street Journal, and in that op-ed, they claimed a San Francisco lawmaker had pushed to abolish single-family zoning in California. And the lawmaker they're talking about is Democratic State Senator Scott Wiener.
Yeah, Wiener, he's the author of Senate Bill 50, the bill that would have allowed for more high-density housing but stalled out.
That's right. And so Trump and Carson, they got part of this right. Wiener's bill would have eliminated some zoning, but only the kind that exclusively allows for the construction of single-family homes. And so the lawmaker, he wanted to allow for more building options, but by no means would his bill have stopped developers from being able to build new tracts of suburban-style single-family homes. That context was ignored by Trump and Carson. We rated the claim half true.
It's always a good day on Insight when we have Cap Radio's PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Randall.
So it's doubtful that Senator Harris would be where she is today if it hadn't been for a 72-year-long social movement led by women to change the U.S. Constitution. 100 years ago today, the 19th Amendment was ratified, giving women the right to vote. Mona Siegel is professor of history at California State University, Sacramento, or Sac State, as most of us call it, and the author of the 2019 book, Peace on Our Terms, The Global Battle for Women's Rights After the First World War. And Professor Siegel, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So the 19th Amendment was ratified on August 18th, 1920. What did it take for suffragists, both women and their supporters, to push the amendment over the finish line?
Well, Wednesday, August 18th, 1920, marked a real milestone in American suffragists' long fight for a federal amendment to the Constitution that would mandate a citizen's right to vote cannot be denied on account of sex. This amendment had been drafted by Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and first introduced into the Senate all the way back in 1878, mm-hmm. incidentally introduced by a senator from California. And it would take 40 years for this amendment to finally clear Congress in June of 1919 when it was sent to the states for ratification. In order to be adopted, of course, the amendment needed to be ratified by 3/4 of all states. The magic number in the early 20th century was 36. Uh-huh. California came in right in the middle. It was the 18th state to do so. But by March of 1920, 35 states had ratified and the movement had stalled out. That final state had proved elusive. Mm-hmm. So on August 18th, 1920, this final fight came down to the state of Tennessee. And for weeks, suffragists and anti-suffragists had been pouring into Nashville to try and turn the tide. The antis came with free-flowing whiskey and all kinds of racist warnings that women's suffrage, which would include the enfranchisement of Black women, would imperil white supremacy and the way of life in the South. And on that morning of August 18th, Tennessee legislators entered their chamber wearing flowers in their lapels, indicating their loyalties, a yellow for suffrage and red against. And those that were keeping count at the door knew that the colors were evenly divided. So it did Wow. not look like it was going to pass. But Uh-huh. when the roll call finally came, the youngest member of the Tennessee legislature, a man by the name of Harry Byrne, despite his red rose, voted yes, in uh-huh. part because he had a letter in his pocket from his mother telling him to be a good boy and do the right thing. And with that vote, the amendment passed. And just over a week later, it was signed into law by the Secretary of State.
So, Professor Siegel, I read somewhere, I think it was yesterday, that the suffrage movement is the longest organized social movement in U.S. history. Is that right?
In many respects, that is a very valid argument. And I think you opened by saying, you know, this stretched back 72 years. In some respects, we can stretch this all the way back to the founding of the Republic when Abigail Adams reminded her husband that all men would be tyrants if they could, and that women would not hold themselves bound by any laws in which they had no voice or representation. Uh-huh. But in terms of an actual organized movement that got off the ground in the middle of the 19th century, started by female abolitionists, both Black and white, who rebelled against women's second-class citizenship. And by the second half of the 19th century, they were holding regular national conventions, delivering petitions into the hands of legislators. They were going to court. This was mentioned on NPR News this morning, Susan B. Anthony's famous trial in 1872 for attempting to vote. That same year, Black suffragist Sojourner Truth also attempted to vote in Michigan. And then by the early 20th century, suffragists were taking their fight into the streets, staging elaborate parades to draw attention to their cause. A famous one in Washington, D.C. in 1913, but many at the state level, like in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where Anglo and Hispanic women marched together in 1915 in support of a federal amendment. And then finally, during World War I, this kind of culminated with militant suffragists of the National Women's Party standing as silent sentinels outside the White House, decrying the hypocrisy of President Wilson, who was calling for fighting a world war to make the world safe for democracy, but refusing to extend democratic rights to half the population at home.
So, Professor, considering the huge chunk of history that you just described there, stretching all the way back to Abigail Adams, do you feel that this social movement gets a big enough chunk in today's history books?
No. But this, you know, has a long history of women's history itself being seen as tangential on the side of real history. And women's historians have been fighting this for decades now, explaining that really the fight to build a democracy in this country is wound up in individual stories of all kinds of social groups, women prominent among them, to finally lay claim to the rights that seemed to be promised at the get-go and were never delivered.
And in history books, we sometimes see it written that women were granted the right to vote in 1920. How do you feel about that wording?
I don't like that verb very much at all. It makes it sound like it was a gift from generous male voters or legislators. Women fought tooth and nail, and they won the right to vote state by state, and then finally at the federal level. And I would also continue, many women carried that fight on beyond 1920, because the 19th Amendment, while it prohibited discrimination on the basis of sex, it did not prevent many groups of women in America from being denied the right to vote, sometimes for decades after.
Professor Siegel, Black women played a role in getting the 19th Amendment passed, yet two very notable women, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, largely ignored their contributions in the History of Women's Suffrage book. What do you think about how that's played out?
Well, unsurprisingly, given how baked, how much racism is baked into the culture of America, it was prominent, sadly but true, in the suffrage movement as well. Part of this stems from the fact that the 15th Amendment, which was passed in 1870 after the Civil War, enfranchised Black men, but not white women. And this infuriated Stanton and Anthony, who complained bitterly about it for years. And the other problem is that as the suffrage movement progressed, white suffragists began to realize they were going to need the support of Southerners if a federal amendment was ever going to pass. And they were pretty willing to employ racist arguments and to marginalize Black suffragists if that's what it took to get there. So there was definitely racism prevalent among some of the leaders of the suffrage movement. At the same time, I really do want to emphasize how truly diverse the suffrage movement was. Mm-hmm. My daughter's junior high school here in Davis, California, is named for Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, a 19th century African-American writer and suffragist who argued passionately back in 1866 that the fate of Black, white, rich, and poor women were all bound up together. And the suffrage movement depended on the strength and determination of a truly diverse group of women throughout its history.
I understand there were also disabled and queer women that were part of the movement.
Absolutely true. When it comes to the question of sexuality, women and men both discussed it in different terms in the 19th century. But there were women, many women at the head of the movement engaged in lifelong single-sex relationships who drove the movement forward.
So 100 years ago, I mean, it's been 100 years now. What would you want girls learning about this moment in history today to walk away with, the importance behind what happened a century ago?
I would say two things. I mean, often, you know, we enter our lives at a particular historical moment and assume everything has always been that way. And girls, and for that matter, many women, have grown up in a world where not just the idea of women voting, but the idea of women in politics is taken for granted. And so I certainly want girls today to understand how very, very hard their grandmothers and their great-grandmothers had to fight, to understand the extraordinary resistance. And then I would also want them to be inspired by the life stories of these many, many women who did not give up in the face of what felt like insurmountable hurdles, and who recognized and cherished the right to vote. And, you know, maybe this takes us right back to Michelle Obama's speech at the DNC last night, where she spelled out in about as clear of terms as possible that voting is not just a privilege, it's a necessity if democracy is going to thrive.
Mona Siegel is a history professor at Sacramento State. Thank you so much for the history lesson today, Professor Siegel.
Thank you very much for having me.
Still ahead, we'll look at modern women in politics as they share insights from their political careers, including a mayor of Sacramento and California's current lieutenant governor. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. So a little more history. We just had a history lesson, but I love this story. Okay, so the first woman voted into U.S. political office was Susanna Salter. Okay, she was elected mayor of this small town in Kansas back in 1887, Argonia. After men who felt women were treading where they didn't belong added her name to the ballot for mayor as a way to really embarrass the movement. Well, she won. In Sacramento, we have only had two women elected as mayor. Joining us now is the second to do so. It's Heather Fargo. She was mayor from 2000 to 2008. And Mayor Fargo, thank you for joining us on this, the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment.
You're welcome, Randall. Thank you for inviting me.
So what did it mean to you when you were first elected mayor in 2000? Did you think back on some of those moments in history that we've been discussing?
Actually, when you're running for office, you're so wrapped up in the actual campaign that that you're not too focused on what happened beforehand. I'm not sure I really even understood the significance. I didn't realize that I was becoming only the seventh woman ever elected to the Sacramento City Council, despite the fact we're the oldest city in California.
Right. And so what were some of the challenges that you faced in your run-up to the election? Did your gender come up at all?
Oh, yes. Gender always comes up when you're a woman running for office. It seems to always be kind of front and center as an anomaly as opposed to the norm. But, you know, when I was first elected in 1989 as a councilwoman, I became the fifth woman on the council. And for 3 years, the only time in Sacramento history, we had a majority of women on the council. We had five women. And of the four men, one was Hispanic and one was Asian. So we were a pretty diverse council back then. But within 3 years, we were down to just me. And we had to go a few more years to start adding women individually back to the council. So we are still only at 12. Angelique Ashby is the 12th council member. When Katie Valenzuela takes office, she'll be the 13th.
Oh, right.
And hopefully when Mai Vang joins us, hopefully, then we'll be up to 14.
How do you think the scope of women in politics has changed from when you first took office a couple of decades ago?
Well, I think that politics in a lot of ways is more complicated because the world is. And things always came up that you didn't anticipate. I mean, there were always, you know, one thing you get a lot of in local government, and I think in any level of government, is variety. And it's never boring, and there's always something new. I think that now there is a greater expectation that women will have seats at the table, but the reality is still not there. I mean, we're still only at, you know, 25% of women in the U.S. Senate and 23% in the House of Representatives.
And two of the senators come from California.
Absolutely. And hopefully when the governor appoints a new senator, he will appoint a female as well, so we can maintain that tradition now.
So what does it take, Mayor, to get younger women or girls interested in politics as a career?
Well, I think that a lot of women kind of naturally are attracted to it because it is about doing good. It's about changing the world for the better. It's about having an impact. And all of those things are things that I think we gravitate to. I think the difference is that a lot of young girls and women still don't actually visualize themselves in those powers of authority, in those positions of power, and nor do a lot of men. And I think that that's one thing which is changing now. There's a lot of organizations that are supporting women and urging women to become involved in politics and really, you know, find their voice. And we're finding that to become a reality, which is very refreshing.
Yeah. So as we've mentioned several times on this program today, we're on that 100th anniversary of women winning the right to vote. And back in 2016, women outvoted men during the presidential election. That's not unusual, but does it matter enough in terms of getting more women elected? Is it women electing women, or can women, are women those types of candidates that pull everybody in?
I think that women are supported by men as well as women candidates. And I think it's important because, frankly, the men, while women tend to vote more, women tend to be more involved as volunteers on campaigns, men still tend to give more money. And they essentially give more money to men, but we're finding that more men are now also open to the idea of donating money to women. And if you don't get money in your campaign, you can't share your voice, you can't share your message. And so it's important that, you know, you are, that everyone in the community, you know, or in your district, whatever you're running for, knows that you're running and, you know, can see a way to support you. But certainly women supporting other women is a real, very important component of getting more women elected. And certainly we would like to get to parity. There's still an awful lot of, you know, gender discrimination in the country, whether it's in the corporate world or the government world. And we need more women to be, you know, at the helm.
We certainly see women in very high positions here in California. In fact, the state's lieutenant governor is going to join us in just a moment.
Yeah.
But is there there's a glass ceiling in California still?
I think there's still a lot of glass ceilings pretty much at every level of government, whether it's California, whether it's the United States, locally, nationally, I mean, even internationally. I think that we have, I think it's only about a quarter of the women, a quarter or 24% or 25% of women in local parliaments, or, you know, throughout the world are women. So we still feel, you know, gender discrimination and still are seeking gender equity. And, you know, some states and some nations have actually required a certain minimum number of women. No one has ever required 50%, but if you can get to 40, that's sort of seen as, and most of us feel that if you can get about a third of the positions on any given board or body, that that tends to really change the discussion. And there's more discussion of health, of education, of children, of childcare, of parity, of equity, of all of those things. And so that's why we're trying to get more women elected.
Before I let you go, I do want to get your perspective on something not related to this topic. You were against the building of a new sports arena in downtown Sacramento. And of course, now we do have the Golden One Center. And that was brought about by the man who ran against you in 2008, Kevin Johnson. Do you still hold that the downtown arena was a bad idea?
My opposition was not to the location. My opposition was to public funding. I did not think that the city of Sacramento needed to support billionaires in their quest to build an arena, whether it was in Natomas or downtown. I actually proposed a downtown location initially was kind of scoffed at by a number of people. It's added a lot of energy to downtown. I've always been a proponent of downtown revitalization. I think it's done a lot. But my opposition was to the public financing, and I still am opposed to public financing of you know, major sports venues. I don't think that we need to be involved in subsidizing that.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. Former Sacramento Mayor Heather Fargo, thank you for joining us on this historic day.
Thank you.
California's Lieutenant Governor is Eleni Kounoulakis. While she's not the first Lieutenant Governor in the history of our state, she is the first elected Lieutenant Governor. She was sworn in by Governor Gavin Newsom on January 7th, 2019, a ceremony that has not been done in recent history. When we originally reached out to her office, we had asked to talk about her career as well as a reflection on what this day means to her. And due to the news that has sprung up recently regarding the heat wave and power outages, we asked if we could address these issues before we talk about this day in history. So, Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Randall, it's great to be with you. Thank you for having me on. And really, thank you for starting the conversation with something that is very much top of mind for people, just because that's my job, is to deal with the everyday. And it's extraordinary. This heat wave is unprecedented. I know people are feeling it in their homes now every day, looking at the weather reports that are showing 100-degree temperatures for the next many days. And between now and Wednesday, rolling blackouts in the state, which we haven't seen for, I think, 19 years.
19 years. And last night, we were right up against the wall on that. A stage two emergency had been issued. So it looked like they were going to be imminent, but I don't believe any actually happened. Where do you think we're positioned today in terms of power for the state? Because it will be hotter today than it was yesterday.
That's right. And basically, we are experiencing temperatures that are 10 to 20 degrees more than average.
Wow. And when you think about average in Sacramento is already hot this time of year.
It's already so hot here. I grew up in Sacramento. It's a hot place. Down in Death Valley, the temperature on Sunday hit 130 degrees.
Yeah.
That is the hottest anywhere in the world in recorded history.
The hottest unargued temperature, right?
Right. So, yeah. So these are extreme temperatures, which we know the scientists have been telling us now for a long time are connected to climate change and global warming. So we are in coping phase. And as we in our efforts in California with our 2045 goals, our shift to renewable energies, we're doing all these things, but we're also going to have to continue to cope. And this is one of those moments. So the independent systems operator, the ISO, I encourage people to follow their tweets. They have been talking about why do we have these rolling blackouts? How come we haven't developed capacity within the system to be able to handle these high peaks? They were arguing that we should be able to handle these high peaks.
Because they were pushing for more sources of energy days ago, right? Saying that we're heading into a problem.
That's correct. And the governor has expressed his outrage and called for an investigation. And I have every reason to believe that we will uncover what's behind it. But in the meantime, just like with COVID, we are now in it together. And the most important thing we can do is between 3 and 10 p.m. to just try to dial down our energy usage. So if you have laundry to do, please try to do it in the morning. If you can turn your air conditioning down during those peak hours, obviously we want everybody to be safe, but we really need to try to flex that power that we have as Californians to try to reduce the amount of energy that we're using between 3 and 10 p.m.
So now let's go ahead and thank you for that update, Lieutenant Governor. Let's switch to the topic at hand now, which is women in politics on this 100th anniversary of the right to vote for women. What's the biggest barriers still facing women political leaders as coming from one of the top elected officials in the state?
So let me just say, this is really amazing. 100 years ago this week, the 19th Amendment was ratified. It's really pretty neat. And it gives us this great reflection point. There's a lot to say about it, but you just had Heather Fargo on. So I just want to say, you know, she was a role model for me.
Right, because you grew up here.
I grew up here and I worked here. I moved to San Francisco when I married my husband back in 2000. But up until then, I was primarily, you know, Sacramento girl, born and raised. And Heather really was an amazing role model. And I remember her campaign because she wore a hat. And it was really interesting. She'd been on the city council. People knew who she was. But as she presented herself as a leader in that level, as being a mayor, she put this hat on and she campaigned in it. And it was sort of a straw hat. And I don't know, I want to say it had flowers on it, but it was just this sort of signal that this is what a leader can look like, and I'm not scary, and I can do my job, and there's no reason that even though something is different, that people shouldn't be worried about it, that it's all going to be okay.
Right.
I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it does.
It interesting. Yeah. And
Lieutenant Governor, I'm sorry, I hate that we're running out of time because I would love to ask you so many more questions. In about 20 seconds, can you, I know that Senator Harris encouraged you to be in the role that you're in now, to run for office.
Right.
What are your hopes for her moving forward?
Oh, I'm so excited about this. It is historic. It's the first woman of color ever to be on a major party ticket. She's an incredible person. She's our very own California senator, daughter of immigrants. She represents the California story, ideals, values, progressive values, joyfulness. And I think she's just going to represent us and the entire country very well.
California's Lieutenant Governor Eleni Kounoulakis, thank you for making time for Insight today. We appreciate it, and for the update on the power outages as well.
Happy to be with you, Randall. Thank you for having me.
And that is Insight Today. I'm Randall White. Producer Cynthia Lopez shouldered much of the production for today's show, and she reached out to Senator Kamala Harris's office for a reflection on the passing of the 19th Amendment, and Senator Harris was nice enough to provide us with our last-minute insight.
As we recognize the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, let us remember the countless women of color, including Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, and Mary Church Terrell, who were essential in the fight for women's suffrage, and that our work continues to protect every American's right to vote.
And we're also helped by producer Kyle McKinnon, our digital team, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Helga Salinas, technical director Mark Jones, engineer today Antonio Munez, Insights managing editor Aram Sarkissian, and Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. As always, thank you so much for listening to Insight, and we'll be right back here again tomorrow with some self-care tips.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.